Some people are moved towards religion out of intellectual curiosity or intellectual interest. They approach religion academically as a subject of study. Others are moved to religion because it gives them uplift. It is a contrast to the ordinary everyday life, which they find desirable for themselves in their own lives. Still others are moved to religion because they seek some sort of anchor from outside, the authority of established religion and so forth. To them, there is no security for their own inner life without orthodox religion. Others are moved towards religion because they seek some sort of consolation or an assuagement of present trouble or sorrow. Others are moved towards religion because they feel that through religion they can find a meaning in their life, find some healing for being not accepted by the world at large, a sphere in which they are accepted as human beings, as brothers. They are not outcasts of society. Still others are moved towards religion because they want to discover ways and means of bettering themselves and bettering the world in which they live. There are some who are driven to religion through sheer frustration and horror in their lives. But by contrast to this group, there are others who are driven away from all conventional orthodox religion, all doctrines and dogmas which are dubbed religious, simply because of the actual world condition and or their own condition. It's so horrible, so awful. And there are those who look at their own condition and think of it as their personal problem. And they also look at the world condition and think of it as the world problem. Almost always, with very rare exceptions, the two are separated in their minds. The problems of society, the outer world, and particularly of distant countries and so forth, are their business, their affair, not mine. Now, if we look, or let me put it this way, if we are capable of looking with insight, with real wisdom, we shall see that this division between the individual problem and the world problem is an altogether false division. The world and I continuously interact. I call myself I as a separate individual being in the world simply because I think of myself as separate. Everybody in the world calls himself I, and every other person you, just as I do. You, I, these two pronouns are mere words which serve the purpose of distinguishing one psychophysical organism and its life from another psychophysical organism. But in reality, every one of us is completely part, integral part and parcel of the whole world. So to talk in terms of the world and I is to talk unwisely, ignorantly. We talk in terms of my suffering, my problem, my joys, my successes, and your joys, successes, problems, suffering, or the world's joys, successes, problems, suffering, and so forth. Actually, there is suffering as a universal phenomenon. There is pleasure as a universal phenomenon. There is fear as a universal phenomenon, and so forth. Now we must take into account this fact, that as far as our personal life and relationship to the world is concerned, we cannot do anything to better the world unless we ourselves are purified. Whatsoever I touch with my own dirty hands is bound to get sullied. It's impossible for me to clean something else as long as my hands are dirty. Now this is something which the brain may logically accept. But having done so, it is just put on the top shelf and we carry on as before, touching everything with our sullied hands. This is what we do, in actual fact. Those who are in some way or other aware of this see that it is essential to purify oneself. But if they just stop there, they will again have a limited, finite view, a fragmentary view. There is no such thing as thinking of myself as a separate entity which has to be purified. My purification is continuously and constantly bound up with the world purification. I must be awake to this. I must be fully aware of this. If I am, then I will not be so foolish as to interfere with the world process. I will be able to begin to make the right response in the right way, in the right situation, to the world, in the process of my own purification. Because, after all, the world and I are continuously interacting. We cannot live unto ourselves by any manner or means. Therefore, we are interacting with the world. But if we live in this state of dichotomy, this fragmentary feeling, I and the world, as two separate things, then whatsoever I think, feel, say, do in relation to the world will always have the seeds of disruption, of breakup in them, because in my inner consciousness I separate the two. Now in this connection, one must be careful not to indulge in this false self-identification with what is, in common parlance, external to oneself. And by that I mean this. There are literally thousands of very well-intentioned good people by any of the fine standards of the world, good people who devote themselves to the cause, who live unselfishly as such. But this actually is a mistaken view. Working for the cause is working for myself. Working for my family, for my community, for the nation, for humanity, for God above all, is only a transference of self-responsibility onto the larger whole. I wriggle out of it. The actual relationship with the larger whole is there. I can't get rid of it, in fact. But if I look at it this way, I shall be very subtly self-centered. My activities will still be self-enclosing. How? Why? Because how can I escape the limitations of my own self-regarding, the way I look at myself and think of myself, by merely thinking of other people, the community, the world? I only see them in my own image. See, this is a very deep and a subtle thing. That is why it is essential to be alert and try and be free from this separation born of self-consciousness, this egoistic misperception of one's true being. The term one's true being is not to be translated as some mysterious, superfine, perfect entity lodged inside the unclean self. Not that way at all. See? But this conceptual self-regarding is invariably an egoistic misperception. And we have to be alert to the fact that this continuously takes place. Now, there is another very important question involved in the approach to this business of purification, of living the religious life, and so forth. We are so conditioned by our life in the physical world of affairs, where we are constantly engaged and necessarily engaged in what we call positive action, that we transfer this idea of positive activity, positive doing, upon our spiritual life and impose it upon our psyche, upon the mind. Now, this is quite the wrong way. The world of physical things is a strictly defined world. A chair is a chair, a car is a car. A radio set is a radio set. If anything goes wrong, such and such positive things have to be done in order to put them right. And by the use of our senses, by the skills that we have been taught, we know precisely what part of the mechanism has gone wrong and how that mechanism can be put right or replaced by a part, another manufactured part, which fits into that mechanism. You see, we are so accustomed to this that we automatically transfer that conception of the know-how into the realm of the mind or the spirit. And this is hopelessly wrong. The positive doing spiritually consists in terms of refraining from evil. There is no such thing as a positive doing of right. If we refrain from the wrong, the right is there, naturally present. If the body, the living body, is free of disease, it is healthy. When we are ill, in pain physically, the doctor doesn't give us some stuff or some magic potion which is positive health which you put in, which drives away the disease or the ill condition. Not at all. We remove the ill condition. Every time it is a case of removing that which is ill. This we really must appreciate. Otherwise, we'll just go on in the usual way, blundering along, suffering from this extraordinary delusion that I, the confused, the troubled, the distressed, the sorrowing, foolish, ignorant person, can possibly conceive what is right and good and set it up as a force against what is evil inside me. It is this negative thing which is the important thing. To refrain from doing harm. To refrain from taking what is not given freely or rightfully earned. And so on. To refrain from all stupid sense indulgences. Indulgence, sense indulgence means that which you deliberately and graspingly, greedily, passionately pursue in the way of a sense pleasure. Sense pleasures will inevitably come, just as sense pains will inevitably come. We have eyes. Supposing we are in the country, beautiful woodlands, lovely sunset, starlit night, or whatever it is. Or we see charming, attractive, beautiful, handsome women and men and so forth, you see. Well, of course there is delight to one's sense. But deliberately to set out to grasp delight is where we fail. Because this is the way of bondage and to bondage, not the way to freedom. On the other hand, the very fact that we have eyes means that we will inevitably come across horrible sights, ugly sights, sights of pain, cruelty, distress, all the rest of it. So then, we have to be alert and awake and respond in the right way to the situation, instead of being driven by aversion or fear to run away from the situation or to break up the situation. That way lies no cure, no healing. So you see, to refrain from sense indulgence has a profound significance and meaning. And then, of course, the simple teachings about speech. Let speech be always truthful, unmalicious, not gossipy, not slanderous, not unnecessary. The Buddha explicitly, in great detail, puts out so much most valuable teaching about speech. To keep quiet. This is very important. We must watch ourselves wherever we go. We have tea, we have a meal together, or we are walking together, or meeting people or something. It's an endless noise of chatter instead of the music of human conversation. Isn't that the fact? This endless chatter. The moment we come into a room, we feel, having exchanged the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy, as the Buddhist scriptures so charmingly put it, the moment that is over, there we are, chatter, 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 chatter. Just be quiet. And be observant. Instead of which we make an awful clatter. And when nobody is present, look at the way we clatter with ourselves. Now you see, this is very important, because this, in our modern civilization, is one of the most terrible ways in which we squander our energy. It goes in this ceaseless chatter, either aloud with other people or silently within our own brains. It's a squandering of most valuable energy. It's an incontinence. A real incontinence. And one of its most harmful effects is that it deprives us of the power to be clearly and sensibly observant of the fact in the immediate now. It ruins our power of observation altogether. You see, it is a little bit like this. If you want to see something in great and clear detail, and of course the thing that you want to see allows it, you can use a microscope. But having focused the microscope, you must keep your eye steady at the eyepiece. You can't be wagging your head about and hoping to see the details which the microscope will reveal. You've got to be still, quiet, undisturbed, poised, balanced. And at the same time, the brain has to be silent and not keep chattering on its own. Then that which the microscope reveals can be observed and known. Now consider the situation of meeting another person. If there is this immediate, endless chatter going on, how can you observe the other person? How can you truly look? You might look with greed. Ah, she's a nice bit of fluff, isn't she? Or he's a fine, strong, handsome fellow, isn't he? And see what happens. The talons of desire are thrust into the living being. Oh, he seems a fine fellow for this particular job. I must try and find out whether I can get him for my purposes. This is going on all the time. This is not looking at another person. This is warring with him, hating him, to look without desire, but giving your whole attention is to look with love, love which is pure and untainted. And just to do that is making the whole world better. This is the truth. To listen not only to a person but to whatever you're listening to, similarly, with attention free of grasping desire, you're listening with love, with wisdom, and you're making the whole world better, and its problems and its distress find a new power for resolution there. So you see, speech, sense indulgence, and so forth, they are most valuable. These are what we call simple moralities. The Buddha went to the extent of saying, they are the minor details of mere morality. Good heavens, if these are the minor details of mere morality, what is high grade purity or goodness? But this is saintship if you fulfill the simple moralities in the true sense. And remember this. The simple moralities are the indispensable basis for anything like religious living, for anything like meditation and the release and the development of the inward faculties of the mind in any sense. It's the indispensable basis for all that. And after one has, let us use the commoner garden phrase, made the journey to its end, trod the path, what is the end point? You live naturally and effortlessly, expressing in your daily life the simple moralities. That is all. As far as your daily life is concerned. But when the simple moralities are naturally and effortlessly expressed, they have become second nature in your life, then you are at peace, a peace which is bliss. You yourself and your whole being and life are the expression for anyone who has eyes to see and ears to hear of transcendent beauty. This is Mother Earth and God the Father's effort come to fruition in the grand sense. Then that person is the true heir of the universe. Don't treat it as, oh, a lovely thought. That's useless. That's so many words. Throw them into the waste paper basket, as far as the words are concerned. But let the word pierce your being and transform it. Let it be a searing light which utterly transmutes everything. That's the only use of the word. And then God steps down from heaven and makes his abode in your heart, in your house, amongst your family and friends. very important to see this. We always inquire, well, what do I do about it? It's the wrong question. Refrain, not do, in this physical sense of the word do. Refrain. Bustle about the least possible amount that our daily life in this world allows us. I say allows us because we have to do certain things to earn a living, etc. The minimum for physical existence. The minimum. Don't make it a painful, forced asceticism. That merely lands us into stupid conflict. Don't, on the other hand, be self-indulgent in any way whatsoever. Enjoy the lovely things, the good things as they come. Don't grasp them. Respond in the best possible way to all the painful and the evil things as they come. Don't run away from them. Don't feel hate and aversion. See? There is, in side by side with this, not in addition to or as a specific task which has to have a certain amount of time and effort devoted to it, but as a whole task. There is the psychological aspect of purification. And here, perhaps, in Hindu Buddhist terms, we have rather a more practical presentation. Instead of saying, love thy neighbor as thyself. How can I love my neighbor when I can't even love myself? I think I love myself, but my ordinary self-love is horrible self-pity and smarminess and just self-indulgence. My self-love is a destructive thing. I don't love the self. I don't even know what the self is. What on earth am I trying to love? I want to love the most beautiful girl in the world. The Buddha also gives a similar simile, you know. But where is this wonderful, beautiful girl? You're in a fool's paradise, just in a senseless fantasy. See? So, instead of the positive, love thy neighbor as thyself, because then I will have certain conceptual pictures that this and that is loving my neighbor as myself. And my conceptual pictures will inevitably and always be tainted with my defects. But supposing, instead of that, I approach the situation this way, that I awaken to all the defilements in my mind. Look, I'll show you in the Majjhima what the Buddha lists as the defilements of the mind. And what, O monks, are the defilements of the mind? Greed and covetousness is a defilement of the mind. Malevolence, anger, malice, hypocrisy, spite, envy, stinginess, deceit, treachery, obstinacy, impetuosity, arrogance, pride, conceit, indolence is a defilement of the mind. A list long enough to occupy me for the rest of my days, is it not? And that doesn't cover the whole field. There are other discourses where various other defilements of the mind are mentioned. Ambition, fear, the desire to achieve, to attain, whether it is honestly, selfishly for oneself, or self-deceivingly for oneself in the name of the others. I'm making £1,000,000 for my son's benefit. Indeed. Now, do we during the course of the day keep alert and awake to this whole host of defilements? They're all there in me. Let me not think that, oh, I'm free from such and such bad qualities and I have got such and such good qualities. I shall get rid of the remaining bad qualities and add on the remaining good qualities. Now, this is the outlook of the ignorant man, and not merely the ignorant man who has a fresh, open mind ready to be taught, but the ignorant of the but coupled with that ignorance is stupidity. It's sheer stupidity to look at things like that. Because when I name a quality, good or bad, I omit its opposite. But in actual fact, the named quality contains within itself its opposite. We live actually in a state of ambivalence. You watch, for example, how desire arises. If you are really awake, you will not only be conscious of desire which you name as this or that desire, but in the hinterland of it, in the twilight portions of that desire, is hidden the opposite of that desire. You want to do something nice for somebody, and if you look very carefully, you will find also the opposite urge present with it. It is a curious thing. But desire always arises dually. When you desire to grasp something, there is another side which wants not to grasp it, to relinquish, or if grasped, to let it go, to relinquish it, not to be bothered with it. If you desire to get rid of something, you will find that in the background, in the hidden recesses of the mind, is the very opposite, to keep hold of it. So this ambivalence characterizes our life: pleasure, pain, kindness, cruelty, and so on and so on. They go together. And you see, when we deliberately set out to obtain something which we call, or to develop, as we call it, something which is considered good, then we set up a conflict between that good which is consciously desired and its opposite, which rises up subconsciously, or rather hides deep down subconsciously. That is a state of conflict. There is another aspect to this conflict. If I think of the defilements as something which I ought to throw out, you see, well, then what is it that I'm trying to throw out? I'm trying to throw out something which is myself. Supposing, for instance, I have an awful cold, I've got a running nose. I don't cut off my nose, therefore, throw it out. Do I? It is true that Jesus put the moralities in rather dramatic and frightening form. If thine eye offend thee, cut it off. But that form is a very misleading form. The theistic, the strictly theistic religions, especially those which arose in arid lands or out and out desert lands, haven't got quite that sort of psychological penetration, that understanding, that gentle healing quality that the religions of more fertile lands have. Generally speaking, this is extraordinarily true of the contrast between cultures that have arisen in the harsh, arid desert lands as compared with the cultures that have arisen in rather more friendly, luscious lands, where life was not so difficult. The problem of survival was not so terrible. So that this element of conflict is one in which I am fighting one aspect of my own being with another aspect. And that leads nowhere. My task is to heal. And to heal means to make whole, not to cut off. Here again we suffer from analogy with the physical. In our physical life, all the time, we are removing what is not wanted, cutting it off. Here, with the psyche, we have to transform it. We mustn't cut it off. There is, in the physical world, perhaps this may be a good analogy of what we, if we are wise, have to do with respect to our own psyche. If you have a certain amount of capital, you don't throw away any part of it. You invest it in the right way. If it is not invested in the best way, the most profitable way, you invest it somewhere else. You take it out of here and you invest it somewhere else. But you don't throw it away. We have, of course, that phrase, throwing good money after bad. But that is a situation where we have altogether failed to make right use of the capital, isn't it? And if we are perceptive, we see that this situation cannot be retrieved, therefore we do not pour more capital into it, not throw good money after bad. But apart from that, you use your capital, you use your resources in the way which will redound to the benefit, the profit of yourself and everybody concerned. Isn't that so? By not throwing it away. It's the same with the psyche. All these things which we call defilements are our own psychical energy which is expressing itself in a harmful way. And therefore, it's a vice. It's a defilement of the mind. It's expressing, the psychical energy is expressing itself in a harmful way. Now to use it so that it no longer expresses itself in a harmful way is our task. And this is the task of healing, of purifying, of transmuting. Use what word you like. Now if you see this, then you will really begin to be able not to hate yourself, not to harm yourself. Bear in mind those wonderful words of the Buddha. He who lives not harming himself, not harming others, lives with a self, become Brahman. The ultimate, the perfect. I mean, one like the Buddha doesn't say such things just without being quite certain that that is the truth. Without harming yourself, without harming another. The effort consists in remaining awake, remaining alert, remaining mindful, watchful. Jesus, the Buddha, were completely at one on that matter. Jesus said, "Watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh." And the Buddha said, "Sammasati, perfect mindfulness, and Sammasamadhi, perfect communion, the state of communion samadhi is." See? And in modern times, Krishnamurti says precisely the same sort of thing, in his own way. Exactly the same sort of thing. Now, there is another aspect which I want to touch upon today, which is very important. We seek to practice the deeper religious disciplines such as meditation, or as with the contemplative orders of the theistic religions, deep prayer, silent prayer as we call it. We must be extremely careful to make certain that there is no power lust behind it, involved in it. This power lust has so many forms, so many tricky forms. The wanting to escape from sorrow, difficulty, pain, and so forth. That is one of the simplest forms of this power lust. I shall be free and dominate my circumstance so that no evil, no pain, no harm will touch me. This is an utterly false approach and attitude. I have to be perfectly willing to integrate all suffering, everyone's sorrow and suffering, into my own being. Which simply means I don't go dinging it up in showerfuls and filling my home with it. Not at all. It means that I remain an open vessel for the inflow and outflow of all the forces of life. In the spiritual life, one must be utterly free of this insurance-mindedness against disaster. In the physical world, we have to have it. That is right and proper in the physical world, under modern circumstances of the organization of physical life. That's quite a different matter. But in the spiritual life, that is a deadly sin. So, we must start off by making certain of our purity of motive. In fact, it's best to have no motive whatsoever, but just to see that this is part of the natural process of the purification of the individual and the consequent release of inner faculties and power. Not to grasp at that power. Now, I think every one of us here knows very well that all the deep inner disciplines of all the religions in the past particularly laid it down as an essential prerequisite that the person's life, not merely outwardly in the world, but inwardly within his own mind and heart, will be a pure life. Free of greed and grasping, covetousness, free of malice, hate, jealousy, envy, all these things. Free of slavery to the winds and storms of passion, of whims, of fancies, of desire, generally speaking, and so forth. This is absolutely essential. Otherwise, if the impure person goes into meditation, into deep prayer, and happens by chance to be successful, so to say, in that direction, he will release forces which on the whole will be terribly destructive to him first and foremost, and to his environment, others around him. Now, you should think about this constantly, very quietly, work out its implications. You know only too well from even a superficial study of the history of mysticism, contemplative orders, monastic institutions, and all the rest of it, how their history is strewn with wrecks, is it not? Insanity, evil doing, and all sorts of psychoses and illnesses of the soul. And in some of the outstanding cases, some of the most terrible pages of human history, say just one word, the Inquisition. See, this is power misapplied. misapplied because entering into the realm of religion, into the realm of conceptions about the soul and destiny and the future and so forth, in the name of that which is transcendent, in the name of God, and no less than God, the inquisitors perpetrated the most ghastly cruelties and horror upon mankind. We, in our little way, do that. We, in our big way, can suffer in our own selves the ill effects of any and every discipline, religious discipline, which releases power. This is what I'm concentrating upon. Be extremely careful about this. Subtly, there is always this seeking for power. A position in the hierarchy. That is the simplest and most childish form of it. But the actual wielding of power in directing other people's lives in the name of helping them or teaching them the way to God. See, I have seen this so deeply. That I take every opportunity to say again and again, I will not set myself up as a teacher, or have followers, or lay down what the other person shall do, must do, or examine how he is getting on, be a spiritual director, which is the usual phrase used in the contemplative orders, the Catholic orders, isn't it? The spiritual director. No? Who am I to be anybody's spiritual director? And put a heavy yoke upon him. No less than Jesus said, my yoke is light. How beautiful.
Other people is that they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne.
My yoke is light. He who was the very embodiment of wisdom and love said that. Now you will find that if one enters into these disciplines of meditation and deep prayer, contemplation and so forth, and the basis of simple, pure morality is not there, the defilements all get strengthened. The situation gets out of hand. You know how in the old days, take for instance what happened in Europe, ancient Greece, the school of Pythagoras, for instance. For 2 years, the first 2 years, the novices were just listeners, the akousticoi. The akousticoi, they just listened. They held their tongues. Literally, we are speaking aloud was concerned, and they tried as hard as possible to keep that silent tongue steady and not wag. Akousticoi, to listen, to listen. In the Upanishads and in the Buddhist teachings, to, you find the first thing is to listen, to hear. The process of shravana, hearing, from shru to hear. Associated with shravana is manana, to reflect upon it. It's the same, it was the same with the Greek schools too. It was the same with the Kabbalists, to listen, to reflect. And to reflect means to let the mind dwell upon what one has heard quietly, and let that which was heard deliver up its secret to you. Continuously deliver up its secret, so that one is saved from that pathetic foolishness which is manifest when one little illuminating flash comes, it takes the shape of a definite thought, and the person says, "Ah, I've got it. I know all about it now." You know nothing about it. Arrogance, conceit, pride. I know. I don't know. Is the indispensable basis for wisdom. And to be quite certain that I don't know. Then that inward mysterious power, wisdom, will function. And the third, after shravana, manana, is nididhyasana, which is contemplation of that which you have reflected upon after the hearing. In modern times we would say not merely shravana, but also the reading, the seeing. You see? Because everybody reads nowadays. I think they do, some kind. You see? All right. Let us put it in a full form. All that comes through the avenues of the senses, the reflecting upon it in the quiet, and then that deep contemplation, this mysterious process, by which the reflecting gets transformed into an inner oneness with the knowledge, so that awareness and being become identical. But this belongs only to the conditioned state. After one has sort of graduated in this preliminary university of life, then the entry into transcendence means the entry into the completely unconditioned state. Penelope unravels her web. What was she weaving? A web.
Not
a tapestry. She was weaving a tapestry, was she? Yes, yes. Well, all right. No, this is in Odysseus's wife, Penelope. You know, in the Odyssey, she waits 10 years for the return of her husband. after the Trojan War is over. 10 years in the Trojan War, then 10 years getting back home. He had rather a shaky time getting back home. And in the meanwhile, lots of suitors were pressing their claim upon Penelope, saying that, oh, Odysseus is dead. And so she said, all right. Finally, they became so threatening and troublesome that she said, I'm going to weave a web. Forgotten, sorry. To weave this thing, you see. And when I have finished it, I will choose one of you. Well, she wove all day long and she unraveled it during the night. See, that is what had happened. The conditioning and the unconditioning. Now the unconditioning takes place again with Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana in a transcendent way. Here you do not listen to the word, to the acquired knowledge, to the transmitted wisdom, which is your spiritual cultural heritage. Not that anymore. Not the forms. But the dissolution of all forms, all mental shapes, all mind shapes, the complete dissolution starts. So, you listen to no thing. You are completely attentive to no thing. You are in the state of listening, in the state of attentiveness. And in that state, that which is the last limit that human beings hitherto on the globe have been able to touch, is touched and experienced, that which they call transcendence. This is transcendent cosmic energy manifest on its own plane, on its own divine plane. This is the world of God, if you like. You never know it. You can never speak about it. Because all knowing, all speaking is only so many veils, so many pictures, not the reality. You can fantasy looking at the picture of the beloved, but you can't livingly make love with the picture of the beloved. Only with the real living beloved can you make love. So too with God. Now, it is possible to practice this discipline where you tamper with forces which are cosmic. Never try it. The wages of sin is death. Make sure that the basis of purity is there. Be concerned only with that. All the rest will happen by itself. Because that is the way of life itself. That is the way of the workings of transcendence. It will be given unto you if you are pure. If you don't ask, if you are completely unselfed, and in the unself-conscious state, the state of divine unknowing, all this will happen to you. but don't temper. Don't pursue as the ambitious man pursues a desirable goal. The fount of power above all. Leave power alone. Yes.
Is there any condition in which one can lose power? Are there any set of circumstances in which one can use power without fear of repercussion?
Is there any set of circumstances? I think you were absent for some of our meetings a couple of months ago, and so we spent several meetings dealing with this question of power. I'll just very briefly summarize essential points. Leave power entirely alone, because it is invariably and inevitably misused until there is the harmony of love and wisdom in you. When that is there, power will not be misused. Now this is truth, but our world circumstance is such that it is impossible not to be handling and using power all along the line in terms of thought, feeling, speech and action. Because all thought and feeling, all speech, all action is an expression of energy, is it not? Energy is power. Potential, when it is static, quiet, unused, but the moment it is used and directed, it has become dynamic. It is power in action, in other words. Isn't that so? And every thought, feeling, every word, every imagination, every effort, every action is an expression of power. So, there is this challenging, this supremely challenging situation which every human being faces all through his life. On the one hand, it is impossible not to be continuously using power. On the other hand is the great truth that power is inevitably and invariably misused and destructive in its effects unless and until there is the perfect harmony of love and wisdom. You can't wait, so to say, until there is perfect love and wisdom, and then you will use power. So, if one really appreciates that, one sees the greater and greater necessity for remaining mindful, watchful, as quiet as possible, without rushing into an inward conflict because of our ambivalence. In every situation, every circumstance in life, because power will inevitably get expressed. But don't add to that the horror of deliberately seeking it, deliberately using it for your purposes, or the egoistic self transferred to my company, my firm, my family, my this, the other. All right? This is an extremely important and difficult thing. But particularly where the inner life is concerned. Do not pray unless you can pray with a clean heart. Do not even go into the temple unless You can leave the things of the world behind you before you enter. This is not original to me, these are ancient teachings. It comes in the golden verses of Pythagoras. Before you enter into the temple, leave all worldly things behind and then go in. Empty, clean, simple, pure. You see, these old teachings are so deep, so true. But when they became increasingly organized, and when the stupid passion and power lust of mortals started to impose this mechanization in the name of organized religion upon masses of people, then the life went out. They didn't know the inner implications. And so, in certain ways, the life of mankind has become worse for this forcible imposition of religion, that is, conventional doctrine, dogma, and all the rest of it upon people. But religion is the only way, not because it is a separate way, merely different from the ways of the world, but it is the whole way which includes all worldly ways in their sweetness and perfection and beauty, not in their distorted expressions. If you are a businessman and you employ 50 people, if you let your love and wisdom enfold all of them, and your intelligence and skills express themselves in the business, then this is religion. As pure and wonderful as any other form of religion. The same in the family. The same whether you're cooking a meal or painting pictures or writing symphonies or cleaning out drains or whatever it is. If one sees that, one knows what it means to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and soul and strength and all the rest of it. Because show me that which is not God, so that I can relax and say, now I need not love with all my heart and soul and strength. Show me that which is not God. The suffering God, the crucified God, is universal throughout the galaxies. And it is our responsibility just to be simple, clean, pure. So that this which is potential, which is in shadow, comes to light and flowers. And its flowering is not the flowering of a day or a week, after which the petals will fall off and that's the end of the flower. This is the immortal flower. And its fragrance is an immortal fragrance. And you, the living person, will experience it as beauty, as joy, as peace. And you'll be free from the bondage of wanting, of desiring, of striving.